Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Cyrus Farivar, the senior business editor at Ars Technica and the author of The Internet Elsewhere. He is also a radio producer and has reported for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, National Public Radio, Public Radio International, The Economist, Wired, New York Times, and others. And his latest book just out is Habeas Data, Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cyrus Farivar.
Thank you.
And habeas corpus, of course, is a pillar of the law. It's a writ requiring a person under arrest to be brought before a judge or into court, especially to secure the person's release unless lawful grounds are shown for their detention. How do you apply, clearly you're using that as a kind of pun, if you will, how does that apply to habeas data?
Well, so there is actually a legal doctrine that exists in a number of other countries. It does not exist in the United States. That is known as the writ of habeas data. It exists in Latin America, in the Philippines. It has its origins in Germany as well. This is the idea of having individuals having the right to go to not only any government agency to ask for data or information held about them, but also private companies as well. And this is a right that we don't have in the United States currently. So my book, the title of the book is meant not only to sort of allude to this fact, this kind of difference in the law, but also to, you know, as you say, make a nod towards the fact that it is a book about legal issues. My book does talk about what the writ of habeas data means in a strict legal sense, but my book overall is much more broader than that.
So at this point, though, it seems that we citizens are getting it hit from both directions, both from the government and from private industry, particularly with these revelations from what Cambridge Analytica was up to in the 2016 elections. And today, before the Senate, there was testimony from the Cambridge Analytica whistleblower, Christopher Wiley, about how Bannon wanted to use the power of data to stir up the culture wars, and we don't know the extent to which Cambridge Analytica was successful, or the Republicans who were using Cambridge Analytica were successful in getting Trump elected. But there's certainly a component to the overall picture that also, of course, involves Vladimir Putin and the special prosecutor Mueller and his investigation. But are we to accept the premise that we're getting hit from both sides, from the government itself, and then from these big data companies and these big, powerful tech companies, five of which are about the biggest corporations on the planet?
I mean, there's certainly an element of concern when it comes to privacy. There's certainly the private component and foreign actors as well. What my book really focuses on is the use of surveillance technology by government agencies here in America, and focuses on how our laws and our case law and our Supreme Court precedents over the last 50 years, are, or maybe in some cases are not, adequate with the technological circumstances in which we find ourselves today.
So it's pretty clear that technology has overrun privacy, and that there's a huge gap between the slow pace of legal reform and the rapid transformation of technology. But lately, I've noticed, for example, in Russia and in Iran, there have been massive street demonstrations about efforts on the part of the government to shut down a social media platform, Telegram. So what's the difference between, say, Russia and Iran and the U.S.? Russia and Iran clearly want to know everything that their citizens are doing. Is the same true here in America, that the National Security Agency and other intelligence services in the United States want to know everything that we as citizens are doing?
I would like to believe that that is not the case. I would like to believe that the National Security Agency and other agencies are trying to protect the nation against terrorism. And I think that they're trying to do that in the most aggressive and lawful way that they can. That being said, I am troubled by programs, like, for example, the NSA's Section 215 metadata program, which ran from 2001 to 2015 and continues today in a modified form. And it was first kind of made publicly known by Edward Snowden in 2013. Right. This is the program that captures all of our telephone metadata, who called who, when and what day for how long. And this is in the name of fighting terrorism, as a way to determine, what terroristic links can be found by digging through phone records. And I think a lot of us are maybe a little bit disturbed by the fact that the government successfully convinced the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, to use a legal precedent, from the 1970s, known as the third party doctrine, which I read about in the book. And that case, that doctrine came from a case called Smith versus Maryland, which involves a late night mugging in the streets of Baltimore, and how the police were able to obtain without a warrant phone records for one guy, one robber, effectively, 3 days of his phone records. And the FISA court judge ruled that it held that, you know, if it was true that this robber did not have a privacy interest in his phone records over 3 days, then it followed that no American has any privacy interest over their phone records. And so that's what validates the NSA's metadata program. And, you know, I think I and many other Americans find that a little bit troubling.
Well, we know that the business model for Google and Facebook is referred to nowadays as surveillance capitalism, and that enormous amounts of data are collected on us as individuals, and it's monetized, and we get nothing from it. In fact, we become the product.
Well, it's not. I would disagree with that premise. We do get something from it because, I mean, we may not get something financially, but we do get some sort of utility out of it, right? A lot of us, Facebook has 2 billion users worldwide, right? They obviously get something out of using the product. A lot of us use Google services. We use Google and Gmail and stuff. And, you know, yeah, we may not like the fact that they are profiting off of that, but we do get some utility.
And again, I'm speaking with Cyrus Farivar, who is a senior business editor at Ars Technica and the author of The Internet Elsewhere. He's also a radio producer and has reported for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, National Public Radio, Public Radio International, The Economist, Wired, The New York Times, and others. And his latest book just out is Habeas Data, Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. So just to return to the alarming fact that there's a growing gap between the slow pace of legal reform and the rapid transformation of technology. What kind of technology is out there now? We know, for example, in the UK, if you watch, you know, British crime dramas on Netflix, you find out that so much of what the police are doing are looking at CCTV, which is ubiquitous. So that's just one example. What other examples can you give us to scare the hell out of us, Cyrus?
So, you know, many cities in America, including the city where I live, Oakland, California, police have a technology called license plate readers. These are specialized cameras that are typically mounted on top of police cars that can scan license plates at speeds up to 60 plates per second. I just wrote a story for Ars Technica, in fact, this morning mentioned the fact that there's a whole new generation of license plate readers that are now coming up. Rather than only recording the license plate number and the date and time and location at which a given plate was seen, these cameras are now able to record other physical information about a car. Does it have a roof rack? Does it have a spare tire that's visible? Does it have certain bumper stickers? What kind of car is it? What color is it? Various other kinds of things that, you know, previously were, you know, not as, you know, not possible through any other type of machine, or to be collected by a person nearly with the same speed or volume as this type of device can do.
Well, for example, I mentioned the use of CCTV to solve crimes, and that seems to be more and more on the rise. And also, a major crime here in the state of California was just recently solved through DNA, through commercial DNA gatherers, you know, like these ancestry type operations. And this really bad guy has been caught, and many, many murders have been solved, and rapes, etc. So how do you navigate that, the fact that this new technology is helping solve crimes and catch criminals, at the same time it has the potential to be abused?
Yeah, and I think that's a question that we all need to kind of wrestle with, and our lawmakers need to wrestle with, whether that it's at the city council level, at the county level, the state level, the federal level. I think we all need to think about where the appropriate line is, right? This is a question that is as old as our republic, right? The fact that we have a Fourth Amendment to begin with, I think, is suggestive of the fact that our founders were very concerned about the potential abuse and overreach of government power, right? If you read the Bill of Rights, you know, the First Amendment talks about the right, you know, the right to free speech shall not be infringed, right? The Second Amendment talks about the First Amendment talks about Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. And the Second Amendment talks about the rights of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The Third Amendment, which is one that a lot of people forget, talks about that the government cannot quarter soldiers in a person's home. And the Fourth Amendment, of course, protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures. So if you look at these collectively, I think it's easy to understand that our founders were very concerned about the government's ability to sort of run amok and get out of hand. I think that there is, you know, it is easy to understand that if you have all kinds of tools, right, whether it's drones or license plate readers or body cameras or DNA scanning or anything else, that we probably would solve a lot more crime. But there has to be a balance between the interests of law enforcement and the interests of civil liberties. And that's something that is a very tricky balance. And I think that, you know, it's probably true that if we were running DNA scans on everybody and we had video cameras inside everyone's home and outside everyone's home, and we took a bunch of other, you know, surveillance measures, we probably would reduce, you know, crime in this country. But I think if we were to do that, that would make a lot of people very uncomfortable. So I agree, it is a tricky balance.
But already commercial technology seems to be invading people's privacy. And again, it's rather like what we were talking earlier about surveillance capitalism. We get services in exchange for giving up our privacy to private entities who then can monetize it. Gmail is free, but we do pay a price. But don't we have also in homes now these devices like Alexa, Google Home, and Siri essentially are surveillance devices?
Well, I mean, like to take Alexa is Amazon's product, right? As a home assistant, right? But I would say there's a big difference between, first of all, the Fourth Amendment and the U.S. Constitution has nothing to say about what private companies do, right? What Amazon or Google or anybody else does against us, right? The Fourth Amendment and the Constitution is designed to protect us from our own government. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. You know, you're choosing to put an Alexa in your home. You're choosing to use Gmail and you're choosing to use Facebook or any other services or products, right? Nobody's forcing you to do that. You know, you can choose not to. There are, you know, email alternatives besides Gmail. Gmail is probably one of the better and more popular ones, but it is not certainly the only one. You know, same with some of these, you know, home digital devices, right? We choose to bring them into our homes or into our lives. When we're out on the street, right, I didn't choose for the Oakland Police Department to scan my license plate, and yet I know that they have because I filed public records requests that show that they did do that, right? I didn't ask the police to have body cameras in Oakland or in other, again, body cameras are very common in many parts of America now, you know, and I certainly didn't ask for a technology that is going to be here, I think, a lot sooner than many people realize, which is, you know, facial recognition. And the body cameras that exist on police officers today are very, very soon going to have facial recognition capabilities and routinely being able to scan people's faces just as police routinely scan license plates now.
So presumably that would mean that a policeman walking around with a body cam in a crowded street or in a mall or something, the device could pick up a signal of facial recognition and that person could be arrested on the spot?
Yeah, and not only that. I mean, it's important to remember that, you know, it's not just scanning for, you know, suspects or wanted criminals or people like that, fugitives or whatever. It's also just scanning ordinary, you know, law-abiding, tax-paying citizens like you and me, right? You know, for license plate readers, for example, the what's called the hit rate, which is to say the number of successful hits, right? Scans of license plates that match the police's database divided by the total number of scans. In every case that I've ever looked at is less than 1%, oftentimes less than 0.5%. In Oakland, it's something like 0.2%. It's an extremely small percentage, right? So the overwhelming majority of scans are of just regular people's cars going about their business. And I would imagine that facial recognition would be the same. A lot of us, I think, would be very uncomfortable if the police had a record of the fact that we were seen at certain places at certain times doing nothing but engaging in lawful, normal, everyday activity, even if it's activity that we would perhaps wish to keep private, such as, you know, going to a sex toy shop or going to a marijuana dispensary or going to a religious service or going to a gun store or going to, you know, Planned Parenthood or to a doctor's office or, you know, any number of things that are normal, regular, everyday, lawful activities.
Well, as much as I fear the government having this ability, I also fear private industry having the ability. I mean, insurance companies that can find out whether you have pre-existing conditions, in loan applications, looking into your private life. You know, and you mentioned if you go to a pot shop or something, divorces, all kinds of stuff can be used against people. Technology is kind of weaponizing. We've seen how people's reputations can be quickly destroyed. And I'm not suggesting it's not deserved in terms of the Me Too movement and others. But we are entering an era, are we not, of weaponized information being used against people.
Yeah, I mean, again, literally today, the Attorney General of California has filed criminal charges against the operators of a website called mugshots.com, which is publishing criminal mugshots of people who have not even, in some cases, been formally prosecuted or, convicted of a crime. These are people that have just been arrested for whatever reason. And this company, mugshots.com, has this whole service that some people I think would call extortion, where you can pay money to have your photo removed, because obviously being arrested is often quite embarrassing and having your mugshot posted on the internet is quite embarrassing. And so, yeah, I agree. There's a whole slew of private companies, some of whom are more reputable than others, that certainly, offer new challenges for our privacy today.
Well, Cyrus Farivar, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Cyrus Farivar, who's a senior business editor at Ars Technica and the author of The Internet Elsewhere. He's also a radio producer and has reported for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, National Public Radio, Public Radio International, The Economist, Wired, and The New York Times. In his latest book, just out, is Habeas Data, Privacy Versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into today's surprising and encouraging vote in the U.S. Senate reversing the recent deeply unpopular ruling by the FCC to overturn net neutrality.